Thanks, Jamie. I'd like to thank Jamie and Ed for inviting us out to speak today and share some of our views. I don't have any corporate disclaimers that I have to put up this afternoon. I am well known for telling what I think. If you ask me what I think, I'm going to tell you, and quite often that'll differ from what you want to hear. But if you don't want to hear it, don't ask me. And my philosophy is that I have honesty, integrity, and humor, and you're going to get all of that today. And like I say, if you don't like what I say, that's tough. You don't have to listen. What we're going to talk about today, if I turn this on, firstly, we're going to have some promotion of Sayer. You don't fly me 2,000 miles across the country and ask me to speak for free at a conference without getting some kind of promote, so you're going to have to put up with that for a second. We'll talk about M&A transaction metrics and a market overview. That's what we're known for. That's what we do best. We'll show you some current trends in corporate transactions, and we'll talk about how to succeed in a corporate transaction. That'll work for both the junior companies, which are here today, as well as the investors, which are looking to maximize their investment in these companies. A little bit about myself. As Jamie said, I'm an engineer and a geologist, and before I get going into that background, I just want to say that I'm slurring my words a bit, not because I've already been at the bar, but because I'm recovering from Bell's palsy, and it paralyzed half my face. I've had it for about a year. So if you're having trouble understanding what I'm saying, pick up a copy of the presentation and read it all later, and then I'll call you and test you on it. When I came home with this, I picked it up in Vegas on a business trip. When I came home with this, my kids said that I reminded them of somebody, and I said, listen, firstly, you're grounded, and secondly, it has affected my ability to speak, but my brain is still intact. So as Jamie said, I've been in the business for quite a long time, first as a practicing geologist and worked for a major, then worked my way through small companies and into management of other junior companies. I've been at Copic as a presenter, singing for my supper, as I called it, and got into this end of the business when I went to sell my small private company that I was running, and none of the agents that were in town would advise me because they said that my company was too small for them to make enough money on as a commission. And the light went on that there was an opportunity to help junior companies in smaller deals. We have a basin going to smaller and smaller companies and smaller deals, and the agents were looking for bigger deals and bigger commissions, and the red light went on that there was a tremendous opportunity to take my experience in the production game, running companies, and to couple that with the growing needs of the small companies to get help. So that's when I joined Sayer, which is a company which was started by Frank Sayer in 1987 as Sayer Securities. I joined about 4.5 years ago, and the intent was to couple my business with Frank's business, which was had a history of doing valuation and M&A advisory work, and basically put the two together, change the focus of the business a bit, and become a true energy advisor to small companies. So we changed our brand a couple years ago, and basically what we've been focusing on is helping smaller guys do smaller deals. As I said, we've got a 20-year history. We do publications on M&A transactions. We help in doing the transactions, and I'm assisted here today by Tom Pavich, who's my vice president. Tom's got about 10 years of experience in the industry, 7 or 8 of that with Sayer in this role of helping small companies in valuations. We've got 2 BCOMs in the office who are doing all the work today while we're here having fun, and we've got a support staff. But basically, we're a small shop with small overhead geared to do the smaller deals for the smaller companies, all the people that you're seeing at Copic. I'll flash some of the deals on the screen here just to convince you that we've done a few things in recent time. These are some of the M&A advisory deals that we've advised in. We've helped with a couple mergers recently, and we've got one on the go right now. You saw Reese presenting this morning. We helped Longview in the amalgamation between Longview and Reese. We've done a lot of fairness opinions and valuation opinions in the last few years, and you can, again, read about all these in the brochure that you'll get if you choose. So now that I've convinced you that we know what we're talking about, let's talk a little bit about M&A transaction metrics. If we look back a couple of years, 2005 was a seller's market. There was not nearly enough product in the marketplace to satisfy the growing appetite. And that seller's market continued well into 2006. Prices through 2006 and deal counts continued to rise. We sent out an email newsletter to all of our people in our contact base 5 days before the Minister of Finance's announcement. And we declared that the end of the seller's market was upon us and that it was now becoming a buyer's market. So while the Minister of Finance is getting the blame for the Halloween announcement, we saw this coming before his announcement. And we'll jump to that later, and I'll show you why that happened and why he's maybe taking a little too much flack. I don't want to defend the politician, by the way, but we think he's not totally to blame for what happened. So if you look at the value of M&A activity for the last 10 years, you can see that 2005 and 2006 were pretty high. 2001 was a bit skewed because of the Encana, or the Pan-Canadian AEC merger, which added several billion in value. If you take that away, 05 and 06 were pretty high value years. On a production price basis, dollar per barrel per day, you can see the prices on a yearly basis were continuing to rise right through 2006. The thought I want you to hold is on a yearly basis. Similarly, the reserves acquisition price was rising on a yearly basis right through 2006. Then we have the famous Halloween announcement that everybody's been was focused on until the recent Alberta announcement, and now they forgot all about that last Halloween, even though the anniversary is coming upon us. And that was when the Minister of Finance put the stake through the buyer's market and through the seller's market and confirmed it being a buyer's market. Now we know that left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. But before you throw up your lunch, I apologize for that. It is a lunch talk and it is in a little bad taste, but again, if you don't like it, look away. I mentioned earlier that Flaherty was not completely to blame, and you know, you people in Ontario know him as a politician in provincial politics before he went federal. I'm not as old as a lot of you people in this room. By the way, I've noticed an aging population at the COPEC conference, and I need to talk to Ed about that. But I'm not as old as you guys, but I remember his previous career, and he was a comedian. I mean, when I first saw him on the news, I said, I've seen that guy before. He's been around for 50 years or more as a comedian. He was part of the Abbott and Costello comedy team. I mean, look. So you can't take this guy too seriously because he has a career as a joker. I'll leave that on so you can marvel at the coincidence in the faces. It's amazing. I'll have to jump down for this. On a quarterly basis, remember I showed you the yearly basis. On a quarterly basis, we had a big run-up in prices, but early in 2006, prices started to fall. That's Halloween there. Prices were already on the way down prior to the Halloween announcement. There's a bit of a break in slope in the one curve, but the other one just continued on its downward trend. So while Flaherty's taken a lot of the blame for prices coming down and et cetera, I'll wait till you can see the screen to change the slide. While Flaherty's taken a lot of the flack, I think a lot of that is misdirected. Because in our 20-year history of analyzing M&A transactions, we can show you quite clearly that there's a one-to-one in acquisition prices and the price of a commodity. And what happened early in 2006 was the price of gas started to fall off the table, and through the year, acquisition prices came down. Now, while on a yearly basis they were still higher than 05, they were falling all through the year. So first we'll look at oil, and you can see the 10-year history of oil prices, and you can see the 10-year history of M&A prices. It's a pretty good correlation. And if we look at natural gas, you can see the same thing. Now, you got a break in slope in 2006, again, because what happened is the price started out at over $12 an MCF at the beginning of the year, ended the year at a low price, and we had a lot of transactions early in the year at high prices. I'll just hold off again. Well, let's talk then about what's happened in 2007 in the M&A marketplace. It's been a buyer's market. There has been, at the beginning of the year, there was over 100,000 barrels a day of product on the marketplace. There's been many corporate and property packages on the market. And again, I'll scroll through these. You can read the details later. But early in the year, we had a lot of large asset packages. The issues that caused these to happen were lack of services in 2006 led to rising prices, which curtailed drilling and production growth for a lot of companies. Then when the natural gas price fell, you've got people that hadn't been drilling because they couldn't afford the services. value of their cash flow was falling quickly, and they had stressed balance sheets, and they had to sell assets. So we had a lot of small asset packages come out on the market this year. We also have had a lot of large asset packages and publicly marketed companies. And this is what we're going to key on from this point forward, is corporate transactions that have taken place. The majority in value of the M&A transactions in 2007 have been corporate. A lot of them have resulted from stressed balance sheets, and some of the companies I can refer to would be Magnus, Caribou, Bear Ridge, C1, Demaray, Mystique, Vanquished. A lot of these corporate transactions were preceded by small asset sales. Again, Magnus, Caribou, Bear Ridge, Demaray, Mystique, Sound, Expedition. But a lot of the corporate transactions involved the sale of otherwise healthy companies with significant growth potential. Capital, Watch, Expedition, Innova all had growth potential, sold for good premiums to their market price because they had growth potential. Trends in corporate transactions include soft sells or quietly marketed companies, ones that you didn't know were available until you read the news release that the company was sold. There's also been a trend in CCAA returning to the oil patch, and you've seen four that we know of, Point North, Caribou, Mystique, and Vanquish. And somebody said to me, and the price of oil and gas was high, they thought that when times were good, even pigs could fly. And I said, no, they think they can fly, and they jump out the window, and then they fall hard. But in spite of all this, there has been and there is now a viable market for companies to exit, and there will continue to be in spite of everything you're hearing in the press. The buyers continue to be other E&P companies and trusts. Yes, trusts. So how do you do it? You've got to have quality reserves, a quality reserve report, a realistic expectation of commodity prices, a focused portfolio with credible upside, a realistic expectation of the value of your land, seismic, and your equipment, tax pools, and what that all means is you have to be realistic in what you're expecting. You're not going to get a stupid price. People are going to pay what it's worth, but they'll still buy it. We'll touch on each of these points briefly. First, we'll start with reserves. In spite of NI 51-101, which came out a few years ago, we would argue that all reserves reports are not created equal. You've got a perception of the credibility of the various engineers, which is still a big issue. If company X uses reserve evaluator A to do their reserves and reserve evaluator B is doing the reserves as something they're looking at buying, they'll vet it through their reserve evaluator first. And their guy has to like it. So if you fatten it up by taking it to a shop that'll give you lots more reserves than you really have, and that still can happen, you might have a hard time selling it to a guy who uses a realistic engineer. Other issues other than the perception of the engineering evaluator is the issue of pricing, and it's been touched on today, and I'm not picking on any companies when I talk about valuing land, seismic, or pricing. I'm just trying to tell you what we see when we're involved in M&A transactions, talking about how you value things when you want to sell, or as a shareholder, whether you want to sell that company. Other issues are assigning reserves to new pools, which we won't get into today, and valuing equipment. If we look at pricing, excuse me. Back in January 2005, when the price of crude was down here, everybody thought it was heading down. And right now, the price of crude should be $42 to $49 a barrel. And regardless of what a producer thought the price was going to be at that time, these are the curves, price curves of the various engineering evaluation firms. So if your firm was, the firm you use is in the middle of the pack, or anywhere in this pack, and you're going to sell, you can't say, well, I think the price of oil is going to be $80, so I'm going to value my reserves that way. Because the guy that's going to buy your company has got to use a curve that's down here. No matter how wrong they all were, they're all going to have to use those same curves. Now, there's a significant difference in value between these curves, and that equates to a significant difference in valuation of your company. If you look at those two curves, in the first 6 years of production, the price differential in the two reports at the highest and lowest end would equate to a difference in value of 12%. If we go back again, just in this portion of the curve here, the difference between that one and that one would be a 12% difference in valuation of the company. And that's not stepping outside of this box. So you can see people who say, well, I want to use the forward strip or whatever and sell my stock that way or sell my company that way, they're going to have a hard time selling it to somebody who's down here. Now, if we want to talk about natural gas pricing, it's a little more horrific. back in January 2006, the price of gas was up here, and everybody correctly forecasted it was going to come down. It should be $9 right now. It's down here. So if you were a gas producer and you were given an acquisition and you thought the price of gas was going to continue to rise, you might have got a good deal at the time, but you sure got beat up now. But again, it's the same thing as the oil. You got to stay in the box of where the evaluators are. You've got to bank finance. You've got to sell stock. The guy that's buying you has to finance the acquisition. He's got to sell stock to finance the acquisition. So there's no point in getting an unrealistic expectation of your pricing. Now, we often get asked by people, well, what do you think the price of oil is going to do? What do you think the price of gas is going to do? My answer to that is pretty simple. We get price forecasts either monthly or quarterly from the various forecasters. And I tell everybody, when I crack one of those forecasts and it says, please use our last forecast as we see no reason to change this month, then I'll start forecasting. I haven't seen one yet. I don't have a clue what the price of oil or gas is going to do. But I know that I can sell assets and companies based on a proper valuation using a current price deck from a professional forecaster who's guaranteed to be wrong. The day that I start trying to forecast or my company starts trying to forecast, we become that. We're guaranteed to be wrong and we don't want to be there. Okay. So we're telling people if you don't want to price your company out of the market and to avoid an unrealistic expectation, do not try to outsmart the forecasters. Stick with what your reserve guys are telling you. Don't try and fatten up your reserves. If you've got reserves in your company that haven't been evaluated, that might be why somebody wants to buy you in a tough environment like we've got now. If you value absolutely everything that you've got, you get reserves assigned to absolutely everything you've got, why would somebody buy you? They put capital into your company. If they buy you, they run the risk of reserves dropping if that's not there. And if it all works out, they get what they paid for. You've got to leave something on the table for the other guy. The days of pure production purchases are over. You need to have a focused portfolio. I know a lot of you analysts are encouraging people to get bigger, more production. That's how you measure somebody's success, by how big they are. But the company's not necessarily getting better by getting bigger. Companies need to have focused assets, and if they have them, people will buy them later. They'll buy their company. I'll give you an example of that. We assisted Inova Exploration Limited over the last 2 years by selling their non-core properties. They would take the cash that they got from those properties and put them into their core Bakken play down in southeast Saskatchewan and into their play at Blair in northeast BC. And over the 2 years, we sold 50 properties indicated in blue for Inova. That was at a time when we could get them full engineered value for their properties, and we still can. We still see small assets selling for full PV10 value. But their stock was not trading for their full NAV, as it is now. Any company is trading for probably 50, 75% of their NAV. I've been hearing that regularly the last 2 days. You've got a time when you can clean up your portfolio by selling your non-core assets, turning them into money at full NAV, putting the assets into your, or putting the money into your core areas, rather than pushing your stock out the door at 50 cents on the dollar to finance your acquisition or finance your activities. Now, that's in conflict with what the finance guys are going to tell you because they want to measure your success by your production growth. But when Inova sold to Crescent Point in a meeting to finalize that deal in 3 weeks, their portfolio looked like this. Crescent Point paying a premium for Inova because they want these assets. And when you look at that transaction, they got way ahead of the market metrics for their deal. That was in spite of the fact that Crescent Point didn't like Inova's other core area and probably discounted that value. But the discount was not as deep as it would have been if Crescent Point had offered to purchase this. So the message is, if you've got a focused portfolio, there will be a buyer for your company. We've seen companies here today and yesterday with nicely focused asset bases, and we would encourage them to continue to focus them and do what they do best. And if you've got something that's not core to your business and you need to raise money, don't sell stock right now. Sell properties. Another issue is with drilling upside. You need to have drilling upside, but unfortunately, companies that think that the valuation of their upside is merely a math multiplication of the number of acres times a certain industry standard have to recognize that when somebody's buying your company, not all land is created equal. And I can tell you that if you've got 4 acres of moose pasture and 4 acres of undeveloped land in downtown Calgary, they've got significantly different values. The buyer's going to see that. If you tell him that you've got all these plays on the books and you've got all this upside in your company, if you don't have seismic support that shows a good play, which would value your thing properly, then you're going to have a hard time convincing the buyer that he should pay up for that land, and he's going to discount it. He's going to ask you, if your plays are that good, how come you didn't drill them yourself? You're in the business of drilling oil and gas wells. So in an M&A transaction, undeveloped land that you think is prospective is rarely going to get you the value that you think it has, unless it's part of your portfolio, like Innova, having their undeveloped land on the Bakken play in southeast Saskatchewan. Equipment is another issue. We often see people who want to value their equipment. I haven't seen many reserves that can be produced without proper equipment. In other words, it's nice that you got nice new pump jacks and nice new tanks and everything else, but you couldn't produce your wells without them. Your reserves have zero value without them. So those people who try and fatten up their companies by including the value of their reserves or their equipment are definitely off base. Seismic is another issue, and it was refreshing to see the presentation this morning, which touched on the value of their seismic with the caveat that they're actively marketing their seismic and it's a revenue generator. If you've got proprietary seismic that you've shot and put in a box somewhere and you're not doing anything with it, you're going to have a hard time convincing a purchaser that there's real value there. You shot it and it didn't work out. If you've shot it and you're marketing it and you're generating millions of dollars a year in revenue, that's a revenue stream that a purchaser will pay you for. He'll put a multiple of cash flow on that when he buys your company. So different seismic can have different values, again, depending on how you use it. So to wrap all that up, to avoid pricing your company out of the market, you can't overvalue any of your assets. You've got to value them fairly. And like I said, if your upside's that good, you're best to drill it yourself or be prepared to answer the question. Final issue we're going to talk on is income tax. And this is where the trusts will continue to be purchasers, and this is where there will continue to be an exit for people, and this is where there will continue to be a conflict between the people in this room. Right now, the market is tough for junior companies to raise money, and the easiest way to do it is through selling flow-through shares. You do that, and you deplete your tax pools, ultimately. When you go to sell right now, trusts, particularly in about 3 years from now, are going to be looking for companies with focused assets and tax shelter, because they're going to become real tax-paying oil companies at that point in time. If you finance your activities over the next 3 years with only flow-through shares, and 3 years from now you go to sell your company and you don't have any tax pools, you won't find anybody at the party to buy you. If you have tax pools, there might be a lineup at your door. So I'm not sure how you resolve that conflict with the marketplace, and I'm not telling you just because we help people sell assets, but that puts another... gives you more evidence of why selling assets for the next little while might not be a bad way to finance your business. Regarding purchasers, the trusts have proven that they will continue to be aggressive purchasers. There's been a number of trust deals this year. Provident bought Capital for a whole bunch of reasons. Capital, I think that was a $500 million deal, and Capital had $200 million in tax pools and lots of upside. Provident paid over $100,000 per flowing barrel for that company. It wasn't an accident. NAL bought Seneca. Crescent Point bought Rising Tide, a little junior producer that was private. Crescent Point bought Innova, or is buying Innova. E&Ps can be aggressive purchasers, too. Birchcliff is buying Compton's Worsley asset. If that asset was in a company, they'd have bought the company. And we've got international companies showing their face. If TACWA leaves anything behind, there's other people that will show up. TACWA's indicated an enormous appetite for acquisition. Marathon bought Western Oil Sands, and there's more coming. We're getting calls from the States all the time. So to summarize that, I don't think I'm telling anybody anything you haven't figured out already, but you need quality reserves to sell your company. You need a quality reserves report, realistic expectation of what the commodities are worth, a focused portfolio, realistic expectation of the value of your land, seismic, and your equipment. You need tax pools, and again, you need a realistic expectation of total value. So to exit, we would argue that quality companies with quality assets built by quality management can be sold in any environment. It's happened long before the trusts came along, and it'll happen long after the trusts are gone. So we would encourage any of the executives in this room to build your companies fitting that profile. And you investors, buy companies that fit that mold, and you'll be able to get out of them for a profit. And I don't think anything's changed from what we've seen in the past. So if you have any questions right now, shout them out. If you've got any questions in the future, our contact info is in the back of the presentation. And Tom will be pleased to handle any of the tough questions, and I'll take the real easy ones. Yes, sir. Can you speak up a little bit, please, sir? Right? Well, first off, I'll say there's not much to comment on until we know what is enacted. And there's a whole pile of emotional rhetoric in the newspapers about what it could be, you know, the sky is falling and everything else. Right now we know that the government has received some recommendations, and who knows how much they're going to listen to that. So to put a number on the effect is dangerous. But it's a real simple calculation for an M&A transaction. The value of your reserves includes your operating expense, the reserve value, and your royalties. So if the royalties on your assets go up or down, then your value of your assets goes up or down, and the value of your company goes up or down accordingly. People will still want to buy it, just like people are still going to drill wells, in spite of what you've read in the newspaper. They're not going to stop drilling wells in Alberta, because you can still make money doing it. It's just a question of how much money you make. And again, in an M&A transaction, the value of the assets or the value of the company is pinned on the engineered value, which incorporates a calculation for royalty expense. Rob, easy question, please. Okay, Rob Boss asked, he said that he appreciated the analysis of valuing a company on an asset value basis, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, he wants to know if we can explain why there is such a disconnect between the valuation in the marketplace of what a company is worth and why the market is fixated on things like cash flow multiples, et cetera, rather than drilling into the true value of the company. Tom, do you have any suggestions on that? My quick answer is, if I could ever figure that out, I'd be a really rich man, because I don't know. Maybe we should ask some of the people in this room who put out recommendations on companies. Okay. The question was, the question was that quite often when you come to these types of presentations, companies illustrate what their net asset value is, and then at some time down the road, they sell their companies for a value that's significantly different or substantially less, I believe is the way the question was phrased, and asked if we track the correlation between those prices. No, our work is based on what the companies are worth, independent of the marketplace, and with apologies to the companies that are here. The companies that come to these presentations, all, no matter where they are trying to encourage people to buy their stock. The reasons that people buy the stock in a company are not the reasons that somebody puts on a company when they buy the company itself. They're trying to show growth potential because of perhaps their land value or their seismic value, but when somebody buys the company, they might just want one of their assets. And they discount the land value and the seismic value. It probably was true real value to the company. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make here. The company truly believed that was an asset value to their company, but it's not the same value to a purchaser of their company. And there's a disconnect there. Typically, plays die with a geologist. If you've got a geologist in your company, he conceives a play, he's got all these great ideas, you pay lots for the land and you carry that value. But if that geologist leaves, almost every time that land does not get drilled and ultimately has zero value to the company. In an M&A transaction, those types of lands are often left undrilled by the purchaser, so they're not valued by the purchaser when he buys the company. But we don't track it. We track what we believe the company is worth independent of the marketplace. let Tom answer that. We analyze every transaction in the marketplace as part of our publication, every transaction over $5 million. So it's not only the ones we're involved in. We look at every transaction. Part of our analysis is the cash flow or the DCF.
With regards to assets being sold at 10% PV, it all depends on when the reserve report was done. We had, I guess Steve Gibson could attest, we sold some assets for him for Great Plains earlier this year, and all on the offers that we accepted, almost all the properties were sold at NAV of 10%. Majority of the properties that we have sold this so far this year have been in and around that 10% PV, P plus P.
Again, if someone has a current reserve report with current price forecasting, the deals that we see happening, regardless of the environment, just as with the answer to the royalty review question, deals are centered around PV10 right now. And deals that get better than PV10 have real credible supportable upside. And deals that get less than PV10 usually are ones where people, they're lower quality assets, but the median price settles right around PV10 regardless of the environment we're in, because PV10 off your reserve report incorporates all those extraneous factors. Quality of the assets determines the ability to sell the property, but and on a corporate transaction, again, it's all the other extraneous items that may add or subtract value, but the deal metrics are usually centered on PV10. Way at the back. When you're buying a company, you basically incorporate the value of the tax pools into the model to do an after-tax run, and we would suggest to not specifically pay cash for tax pools, but take the value of the assets and run them out over their reserve life by depleting the pools that are there. So 100% pools are obviously more useful, but to sit down and say, well, we'll pay 50 cents on the dollar for 100-cent pools and 10 cents for 10% pools or something like that doesn't always work, because it's better to run them out against the reserves of the company. Alex. There's still PUDs. People still have PUDs. There's still lots of proven undeveloped reserves. I could show you one on my laptop right now on a property we're working up. Do people pay for PUDs is another question. And I guess the way I'd answer that is with probable reserves, my experience has been that if the probable reserves or the PUDs are something that a buyer truly believes he can access by putting capital into the asset, he will pay for them. If they are probable reserves that are probably not there, he's probably not going to pay for them. If they're probable reserves that result from a changing a decline from, 12% to 10% and ultimately recovering more reserves, again, the present value of those probables is going to be close to zero, because there's nothing that a purchaser can do to access those probables or accelerate the turning of those reserves into money. So it depends on the nature of the reserves. If they're just there, and that's what I touched on earlier about fattening up the reserve report, if you've put them there because the reserve evaluator will give them to you, but you don't believe they're there, the buyer won't believe they're there either, and he's not going to pay you for them. So you really have to look at the asset. And that's where the buyers are becoming more educated and more realistic in their expectation of what they're purchasing. Yes, sir. The question was whether assets are changing hands at PV10 before or after tax. And again, that depends on a whole bunch of things, including the taxable situation of the purchaser. If you generate some tax pools out of a asset acquisition that can be used immediately to offset your tax that's generated, or your revenue that's generated, as well as the purchaser has a lot of pools and he believes that the assets he's buying can be further developed, or he has the ability to further generate pools, he might pay PV-10 before tax, or even better. If the purchaser has no tax pools and is just doing a straight production purchase, then his bid might be PV-10 after tax. But what we're finding is that you can almost always find a purchaser who will pay the pre-tax number for assets. There are still a lot of prospective purchasers for smaller assets, and it just takes one to make a transaction happen. Yes, sir, Max. I'll throw this one to Tom because he's responsible for publishing our M&A report. Max's question was that it seems from the outside that there's been less M&A activity than there has been historically, and he wanted to know that if that was true, what would be the catalyst to get it going again? I don't think we're going to have to answer the second question, but I'll throw it over to Tom.
In comparison to last year, we're still seeing the same amount of deals being done. But also, this year we're seeing a higher value of M&A than we did last year, just driven by some of the larger deals. Royal Dutch Shell acquiring their 22% stake in Shell Canada, Marathon buying Western Oil Sands, and then Statoil purchasing North American, as well as Tawkwa doing the North Rock and Prime West deal that they announced last month. So there is still deal flow out there. There wasn't much over the summer, just because normally there isn't a lot that's being publicly marketed, or a lot of people are on vacation. But normally it picks up in the third and fourth quarter, and we also see a lot in the second quarter too. So.
Okay, it appears there's no more questions. I'd like to thank you all for attending, and like I said, I'll encourage anybody to give us a call anytime to ask us any further questions.